Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's 2019 Roundup podcast, where we take another look at some of our listeners' favourite stories. I'm joined here by Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute, who's going to remind us of these stories. Over to you, Kate.
Thanks, Rod. Early in the year, we heard about Patagonia encouraging its customers to keep their coats rather than buying new ones. What a great lesson for everybody who thinks that growth is the only secret to business success. Sadly, here in the UK, we have the collapse of Thomas Cook after over 150 years of leading people on what started to be exploration. We've also seen some new trends emerge, haven't we? We've had the rise of the side hustle, and so much so that one of our editions of our magazine Edge next year is devoted to the gig economy. People earning in that from leisure and having portfolio careers. Another theme that we have heard about so often is the rise of conscious capitalism. And of course, companies like Patagonia are real proponents of that more thoughtful capitalism. And another theme that's been important to us, we've been conducting research in the area, we've devoted an edition of Edge to it, is that for neurodiversity, to think so differently about how people think differently. All themes that have been very popular, and I think these are trends that are going to continue in 2020.
Okay, Kate, and now let's listen to those stories again. Our first story looks at the aims of OECD's B4IG coalition. A coalition of 34 multinationals has joined forces with the Business for Inclusive Growth, led by the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development. In an announcement published in the run-up to the past weekend's G7 meeting in Biarritz, the OECD announced that the companies have committed to step up business action to advance human rights through their value chains, build inclusive workplaces, and strengthen inclusion in their internal and external business ecosystems. The B4IG coalition is the first business-led initiative of its kind. Further members of the coalition include IKEA, Mars, Unilever, and BNP Paribas. Kate, what should leaders learn from this new coalition's aims?
Since 1993, our companion Charles Hampton Turner and his partner, co-author von Strompenaars, have been talking to us about how many different sorts of capitalism there are and how there isn't just one that seeks to maximise shareholder wealth. And with all of these sort of initiatives, when you look at them, they make such sense that one wonders why they haven't been adopted years ago. In an ecosystem where you have a complicated supply chain with many stakeholders, if one profits at the expense of another, it's not so sustainable in the long term. And I think that's what they're saying. We've got to treat people fairly. We've got to treat our suppliers fairly. We've got to treat our customers with respect. And if we're not doing all of those things, something will break. And something is breaking. And these big names are obviously recognising the persuasive business case for running their businesses ethically.
Our next story looks at an article by Daniel Goleman on the Korn Ferry Institute website this week that looks at the concept of purpose and describes the sporting clothes maker Patagonia as a long-time poster child for purpose-driven business. He asks, what keeps this retailer thriving alongside competing brands like the North Face and retailers like Amazon, and argues that the secret to Patagonia's success is its purpose. The original mission of Patagonia is to build the best product, cause no unnecessary harm, use business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis. Kate, to what extent do you believe purpose should guide strategy?
It's not whether I believe it or not, really, in this case, is it? It's doing it. People who work for Patagonia know what it's about, know what they're trying to achieve, and are delivering a really successful business that's based on very sound ethical principles that are obviously shared. And again, you know, referring back to the previous two items we've been talking about, this is in action what all those companies are trying to say. Let's do no harm. Let's do no harm to the environment. Let's do no harm to the people who work for us. Let's do no harm to our suppliers. And if that's your guiding principle, you will get people gathering around it.
Thank you, Kate. Our next question looks at the ethics of second sources of income, so-called side hustles. In its 9th September publication, The Modern Life Report, compiled from a survey of more than 2,000 adults, Fidelity International reveals that almost half of people in their 20s have a second source of income, compared to just 21% 61% in their 50s. The figure suggests that workers are increasingly expected the latitude to perform side hustles in parallel with their primary occupations. Quoted in the research, Dr. Charmi Patel said, "A formal policy on side hustling within employment contracts will become essential. A key issue is compliance. If staff are working flexible hours from home or virtually, the control might not be there on whether they are conducting their own business on company time and using company property and resources to do so." Kate, from the perspectives of both well-being and employees' expectations of how much access they should have to their staff, what are the soundest ethical conditions in which employees can run side hustles?
Well, my first impression on hearing about this is what a shame that Dr. Patel immediately looks at the downside that these people are not to be trusted and that their side hustle is somehow stealing from their main job. It's interesting, again, with the age, it could be that the younger people are not earning enough, and we hear a lot about millennials being unable to make ends meet, but it's also indicative of that blurring between work and leisure that flexible working encourages or allows, and that some people might be doing what we're calling a side hustle, and it might be something that they're passionate and they really like. So it could be singing in a band or being a DJ or whatever, baking cakes, whatever it is they do, they love it. And then it's really a paid leisure activity. But you would only know these as a manager if you're interested in what your staff are doing and you're asking them how they spend their leisure time. You know what they're great at, you know what they enjoy doing, and that's when you can start worrying about whether it's adversely affecting their performance. Take the necessary steps then to talk to them if it's a financial thing. And this, again, where flexible working can really help. It might suit some people with important side hustles to do 4-day weeks. How can you help support them in order to make sure that they're fulfilled, both their main employment, but also outside that main employment?
Thank you, Kate. What must leaders learn from the Thomas Cook collapse? The Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Committee announced on 26th of September that it will thoroughly investigate the circumstances behind the company's demise. Committee Chair Rachel Reeves said, "Amid the frustration of holidaymakers and the misery of thousands of staff losing their jobs, the collapse of Thomas Cook has uncovered what appears to be a sorry tale of corporate greed, raising serious questions about the actions of Thomas Cook's bosses and their stewards of the business." Kate, what governance lessons must leaders take away from Thomas Cook's collapse?
I think firstly, we have to be saddened at the demise of such an old company, and that one actually was founded by a genuine adventurer, Thomas Cook, who was a Baptist and who really saw travel as a force for good. One of the first trips he arranged being a pilgrimage here in the Midlands. It also makes us think what goes on in these senior team meetings when they must obviously be congratulating each other for their hard work or their insight, and actually ignoring the evidence that however hard they're working or however well they think they're doing, they are not delivering the results that are needed to sustain an organisation over the long term. And I'd be so interested to see the minutes. And I think what it reminds anybody in these positions is to be accountable for what you're supposed to be doing, not what you think you're doing well. And in this instance, this was to deliver holidays at a profit, well, for people and to keep the business going. And they have failed lamentably in doing that. And nobody was questioning them sufficiently or holding them to account.
Right, thank you very much, Kate. Our next story asks if a Thunberg effect could boost neurodiversity. Greta Thunberg took time to speak about her own identity as a neurodiverse individual on her recent visit to New York, telling CBS This Morning, "In some circumstances, it can definitely be an advantage to have some kind of neuroatypical diagnosis, to be neurodiverse, because that makes you different. That makes you think differently. And especially in such a big crisis like climate change, when we need to think outside the box. We need to think outside our current system. We need people who think outside the box and who aren't like everyone else." To what extent could Thunberg's presence on the world stage help to boost the number of neurodiversity inclusivity programs already in operation? And what should leaders learn from the breakthroughs that Thunberg has achieved as a public figure?
Well, maybe the Thomas Cook could have done with some more diversity in their senior team, somebody stating the obvious, asking the difficult questions, and being unrelenting in their pursuit of the answers. But what is so sad about this, and is so much the experience of so many underrepresented groups, the lengths that people will go to silence them and to make their viewpoint less valid, less important than the much more typical groups. So good, she has put difference on the world stage, and we need that difference because that's where you get questions, challenge, and of course, as is so well evidenced, innovation.
Thank you very much, Kate. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And a Happy New Year to all our listeners, and a very prosperous 2020.